Okay, so I just wanted to give a short update. And an update is something I haven't given in quite a while. So I want to make a short update. And I think I'll throw up a statistic. And I think this statistic is kind of useful. And the stat is that 2/3 of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. And this is something that many people know, but many people don't really understand. Yeah, okay, it's like, you know the fact, but what's behind the fact? What does this imply? What does this mean for the future of the United States? What does this mean for the future of companies and how the economy functions in the future? And the fact that 2/3 of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, it's quite an alarming fact, because you know, you would think that, and so, okay, if unemployment rises, a lot of people will not be able to afford food. You know, they can't pay rent. And right now, in some states, the rent moratorium is still there. Okay, so, you know, even with rent being, you know, you don't have to pay rent for now, still 2/3 of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Now, what's even more interesting than that is 40% of Americans making over $100,000. 100 grand every year are living paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, that's roughly the top 16% of Americans. And that's a big number, 16%. You know, that's really up there. And 40% of these guys are paycheck to paycheck. Now, that's a really, you know, that really makes you think. Now, a lot of these top 40% people, you know, a lot of these guys live in the expensive cities like New York and California. And these also happen to be, states, I mean, but these also happen to be the states that still have their eviction moratorium there. So, you know, the people who own the house, you know, they can't evict the people who are renting their houses if they don't pay. You know, that's a law that's going on now. But, and these guys somehow are still living paycheck to paycheck, 40% of Americans making over 100 grand. Now, you know, a lot of the people making, you know, money, whether it's 2/3 of Americans in general, or it's the people making over 100 grand, these guys, most of them, either own houses or they're renting. I don't see really the other, I mean, I guess maybe you're living with a friend or something, but usually not for free. So the point is, either you own a house or you're renting. Now, if you're renting a house, the price of rent still hasn't really grown that much, you know, opposed to the price of real estate. You know, generally in the United States, real estate in 2020 has grown 23% year over year. Now, that's a general number. You know, it's grown more in some places, it's grown less in other places, but that's kind of the total average growth of the real estate market in the US. And that's a really big growth, because, you know, real estate does not grow very quickly usually. And now it's doing that, but the price of rent still hasn't really followed. And price of real estate is usually always followed by the price of rent. Now, real estate, you know, and now that you're seeing commodity prices shoot up, and especially recently, you're seeing natural gas just skyrocket. You know, real estate provides a pretty good inflation hedge. Now, I'll kind of say two things. The relation between interest rates and real estate prices, or the price of any commodity, or the price of stocks, or generally speaking, assets. When you have interest rates at basically zero levels, and even long-term interest rates at, you know, very, very low levels, you know, 2% or under, then what you get is pretty much all assets are highly valued. Now, how I see assets is, I don't see really the assets relative to price. You know, sometimes you do have to see the assets right relative to the price and the price you get from the earnings of the assets. But sometimes you have to look at assets relative to interest rates. Now, you know, some people say, well, you take assets and you compare that to the risk-free rate, which is, you know, the rate on treasuries, normally speaking, and then you determine how much your asset is worth. Now, yeah, that's basically the big part of how it works. And so a lot of commodities, you know, their prices are shooting up. And so people think, okay, well, probably inflation is transitory. These prices won't go up forever. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of demand that's not being fulfilled. You know, there's a lot of supply chain issues. And of course, there's a ton of shipping issues. The price of shipping from some places like, you know, China to the US, I mean, it's gone up by maybe almost 10 times since 2020 lows. And so that's a really big, big, big increase. And so you're seeing a lot of these supply chain issues. And of course, this cost push inflation, which is really, really putting a lot of pressure on you know, how much you're earning in terms of real value. And so when everybody's already living paycheck to paycheck and the price of everything increases, either, you know, the central bank right now wants to start tightening. Now, how much can they do that without causing an economic crisis, which will leave more people unemployed? And when you have people unemployed and 2/3 of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, how will you solve that problem without creating more inflation? So you're kind of stuck in the middle where you have a problem and you can't really solve that problem with your current, you know, economic policies for the central banks, at least. And, you know, people are saying the US might even default on their debt, but that to me does not seem very likely, especially since in the last 50 years, you know, these guys have increased the debt ceiling like 57 times in the last 50 years. So, you know, according to history, I don't think this time is an exception, because just, you know, if they do it 57 times in the last 50 years, there's really nothing preventing them from doing it the 58th time. There's nothing new happening. It's all the same. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, these guys can just, you know, the government can just make a $1 trillion platinum coin or, you know, something like that. And debt ceiling problem, well, you don't need to worry about that anymore because, you know, you can kind of just loophole your way out of the system. And so, you know, debt is a big worry, but also kind of the situation of households and how these guys are spending, because they have really benefited usually from interest rates being lowered. But now what you're seeing is even with lowering interest rates, you know, unemployment rate is falling. Labor participation rate hasn't really returned to the levels where it once was. And really after 2008, the labor force participation rate has been falling. And, you know, that's a big issue, but the unemployment rate, you know, it wasn't where it was back in 2019, but it's still becoming lower and lower. It's still going down. And GDP as well is going up, and it's pretty much the highest it's ever been. But also valuations on assets in general have also been pretty much all-time highs. Now, one thing though, if you take the S&P 500, although it's overvalued right now by, you know, historical metrics, you know, you take PE, price to book, or the Shiller ratio on the S&P 500, even though it's high, historically speaking, when you compare to these metrics. When you compare the S&P 500's valuations using these metrics, which would say it's already expensive, but when you compare the S&P 500 to the bond market, historically speaking, the S&P 500 is cheap. And so that's a very interesting distinction because, you know, you're seeing the bond market being completely overvalued and the S&P 500, which is historically expensive, is now cheap if you compare it to bonds. Is the junk bond market different, or, you know, is the junk bond market also overvalued? And I think the junk bond market is also overvalued, but I don't think it's more overvalued than, you know, let's say treasury bond market. I think they're both overvalued. Now, one benefit of junk bonds is, you know, a lot of the companies have more liquidity because interest rates are so low, and so their likelihood of default falls. Now, when we're talking about bonds, everyone's worried about Evergrande. At least they were a week ago. Now you don't hear about it too much in the media or on the news anymore. People comparing Evergrande to like Lehman Brothers back in 2008. You have people who compare the two, and you have others who say, well, Evergrande is not like Lehman because back in 2008, there was a big systemic issue in the financial industry. There was way too much risk. It was a house of cards. Banks and investment banks back then were linked together, and they were lending to people who had, you know, no credit. They had, you know, people who didn't even have, you didn't have to have sustainable income. You didn't really need anything, and you can take out a mortgage. And so then they would securitize these mortgages and sell it to others, and the whole housing market would just shoot up. And then, of course, that doesn't last forever. So that was kind of the systemic problem in 2008. But the Evergrande situation, not as much of a systemic problem. But of course, I mean, the whole incredible bubble of the Chinese real estate market. I mean, maybe you call that a systemic issue as of itself, because, you know, usually bubbles come down, but, you know, who knows how the policymakers in China will decide to kind of combat the real or try to propel the real estate valuations in China, in the big cities, for longer and longer. So, I mean, that's always kind of interesting to see, because if you look at earnings, the incomes of households relative to the price of real estate in China, they have the most overblown ratios. So people earning the least money and the houses are the most expensive. Now, I think there's kind of a cultural aspect where everyone wants to buy a house. You know, no one really invests in stock market, but everyone wants a house. So if you get that, keep on going. And of course, Chinese interest rates are higher than US interest rates. They're not at zero. And so, I mean, at least they can keep on using that tool to keep on lowering interest rates to boost the real estate market. Now, you know, I guess this update has been a lot on real estate, as it seems, but I'll try to keep more updates and focus on some more more specific topics, because a lot of my episodes have been very broad. So this is, you know, going into the future, I'll try to keep everything more specific. And I really want to focus on bigger events. And well, sometimes you have momentary events that cause all this, you know, I guess, outcry or attention in the media, but a lot of them are insignificant. Although right now, what you're seeing in the markets is you're seeing a lot of volatility compared to what you were seeing, you know, a couple of months ago. And that might be a warning signal to investors.